composed of psychological or social miscreants whose twisted needs demand that others be harmed and humiliated. But the evidence does not support such a view. Studies done on the personality traits of fraternity members, for instance, show them to be, if anything, slightly healthier than other college students in their psychological adjustment. Similarly, fraternities are known for their willingness to engage in beneficial community projects for the general social good. What they are not willing to do, however, is substitute these projects for their initiation ceremonies. One survey at the University of Washington found that of the fraternity chapters examined, most had a type of Help Week tradition, but that this community service was an addition to Hell Week. In only one case was such service directly related to initiation procedures. The picture that emerges of the perpetrators of hazing practices is of normal individuals who tend to be psychologically stable and socially concerned, but who became aberrantly harsh as a group at only one time, immediately before the admission of new members to the society. The evidence, then, points to the ceremony as the culprit. There must be something about its rigors that is vital to the group. There must be some function to its harshness that the group will fight relentlessly to maintain. What? My own view is that the answer appeared in 1959 in the results of a study little known outside of social psychology. A pair of young researchers, Elliot Aronson and Judson Mills, decided to test their observation that persons who go through a great deal of trouble or pain to attain something tend to value it more highly than persons who attain the same thing with a minimum of effort. The real stroke of inspiration came in their choice of the initiation ceremony as the best place to examine this possibility. They found that college women who had to endure a severely embarrassing initiation ceremony in order to gain access to a sex discussion group convinced themselves that their new group and its discussions were extremely valuable, even though Aronson and Mills had previously rehearsed the other group members to be as worthless and uninteresting as possible. Different co-eds who went through a much milder initiation ceremony or went through no initiation at all were decidedly less positive about the worthless new group they had joined. Additional research showed the same results when co-eds were required to endure pain rather than embarrassment to get into a group. The more electric shock a woman received as part of the initiation ceremony, the more she later persuaded herself that her new group and its activities were interesting, intelligent, and desirable. Now the harassments, the exertions, even the beatings of initiation rituals begin to make sense. The Thonga tribesman watching with tears in his eyes his 10-year-old son tremble through a night on the cold ground of the Yard of Mysteries. The college sophomore punctuating his hell night paddling of his fraternity little brother with bursts of nervous laughter. These are not acts of sadism. They are acts of group survival. They function, oddly enough, to spur future society members to find the group more attractive and worthwhile. As long as it is the case that people like and believe in what they have struggled to get, these groups will continue to arrange effortful and troublesome initiation rites. The loyalty and dedication of those who emerge will increase to a great degree the chances of group cohesiveness and survival. Indeed, one study of 54 tribal cultures found that those with the most dramatic and stringent initiation ceremonies were those with the greatest group solidarity. Given Aronson and Mills's demonstration that the severity of initiation ceremony significantly heightens the newcomer's commitment to the group, it is hardly surprising that groups will oppose all attempts to eliminate this crucial link to their future strength. Military groups and organizations are by no means exempt from these same processes. The agonies of boot camp initiations to the armed services are legendary. The novelist William Styron, a former Marine, catalogs his own experiences in language we could easily apply to the Thongas, or for that matter, to the Kappas or Betas or Alphas. The remorseless, close-order drill hour after hour in the burning sun, the mental and physical abuse, the humiliations, the frequent sadism at the hands of drill sergeants, all the claustrophobic and terrifying insults to the spirit which can make an outpost like Quantico or Paris Island one of the closest things in the free world to a concentration camp. But in his commentary, Styron does more than recount the misery of this training nightmare. He recognizes its intended outcome. There is no ex-Marine of my acquaintance, regardless of what direction he may have taken spiritually or politically after those callow gung-ho days, who does not view the training as a crucible out of which he emerged, in some way, more resilient, simply braver and better for the wear. But why should we believe William Styron, the writer, in such matters? After all, for professional storytellers, the line between truth and fiction is often blurred. Indeed, why should we believe him when he alleges that the infernal character of his military training was not only successful, it was specifically intended to create desired levels of pride and camaraderie among those who endured and survived it? At least one reason to accept his assessment comes from unfictionalized reality. The case of West Point cadet John Edwards, who was expelled from the U.S. Military Academy in 1988 on charges involving the authorized hazing that all first-year cadets experience at the hands of upperclassmen to ensure that the newcomers can withstand the rigors of West Point training. It was not that Mr. Edwards, who ranked academically near the top of his 1,100-member class, had been unable to bear up under the ritual when he was subjected to it. Nor was he expelled because he had been aberrantly cruel in his treatment of the younger cadets. His offense was that he would not expose the newcomers to what he felt was absurd and dehumanizing treatment. Once again, then, it appears that for groups concerned about creating a lasting sense of solidarity and distinction, the hardship of demanding initiation activities provides a valuable advantage that they will not easily surrender, either to aspiring members who are unwilling to take the harshness, or to give it out. The inner choice. Examination of such diverse activities as the indoctrination practices of the Chinese communists and the initiation rituals of college fraternities has provided some valuable information about commitment. It appears that commitments are most effective in changing a person's self-image and future behavior when they are active, public, and effortful. But there is another property of effective commitment that is more important than the other three combined. To understand what it is, we first need to solve a pair of puzzles in the actions of communist interrogators and fraternity brothers. The first puzzle comes from the refusal of fraternity chapters to allow public service activities to be part of their initiation ceremonies. Recall that one survey showed that community projects, though frequent, were nearly always separated from the membership induction program. But why? If an effortful commitment is what fraternities are after in their initiation rites, surely they could structure enough distasteful and strenuous civic activities for their pledges. There is plenty of exertion and unpleasantness to be had in the world of old age home repairs, mental health center yard work, and hospital bedpan duty. Besides, community-spirited endeavors of this sort would do much to improve the highly unfavorable public and media image of fraternity Hell Week rites. A survey showed that for every positive newspaper story concerning Hell Week, there were 5 negative stories. If only for public relations reasons, then fraternities should want to incorporate community service efforts into their initiation practices. But they don't. To examine the second puzzle, we need to return to the Chinese prison camps of Korea and the regular political essay contests held for American captives. The Chinese wanted as many Americans as possible to enter these contests so that, in the process, they might write things favorable to the communist view. If, however, the idea was to attract large numbers of entrants, why were the prizes so small? A few extra cigarettes or a little fresh fruit were often all that a contest winner could expect. In the setting, even these prizes were valuable. But still, there were much larger rewards. Warm clothing, special mail privileges, increased freedom of movement in camp, that the Chinese could have used to increase the number of essay writers. Yet, they specifically chose to employ the smaller rather than the larger, more motivating rewards. Although the settings are quite different, the surveyed fraternities refused to allow civic activities into their initiation ceremonies for the same reason that the Chinese withheld large prizes in favor of less powerful inducements. They wanted the men to own what they had done. No excuses, no ways out were allowed. A man who suffered through an arduous hazing could not be given the chance to believe he did so for charitable purposes. A prisoner who salted his political essay with a few anti-American comments could not be permitted to shrug it off as motivated by a big reward. No, the fraternity chapters and Chinese communists were playing for keeps. It was not enough to wring commitments out of their men. Those men had to be made to take inner responsibility for their actions. Given the Chinese Communist government's affinity for the political essay contest as a commitment device, it should come as no surprise that a wave of such contests appeared in the aftermath of the 1989 massacre in Tiananmen Square, where pro-democracy protesters were gunned down by government soldiers. In Beijing alone, 9 state-run newspapers and television stations sponsored essay competitions on the quelling of the counter-revolutionary rebellion. Still acting in accord with its long-standing and insightful de-emphasis of rewards for public commitments, the Beijing government left the contest prizes unspecified. Social scientists have determined that we accept inner responsibility for a behavior when we think we have chosen to perform it in the absence of strong outside pressures. A large reward is one such external pressure. It may get us to perform a certain action, but it won't get us to accept inner responsibility for the act. Consequently, we won't feel committed to it. The same is true of a strong threat. It may motivate immediate compliance, but it is unlikely to produce long-term commitment. All this has important implications for rearing children. It suggests that we should never heavily bribe or threaten our children to do the things we want them truly to believe in. Such pressures will probably produce temporary compliance with our wishes. However, if we want more than just that, if we want the children to believe in the correctness of what they have done, if we want them to continue to perform the desired behavior when we are not present to apply those outside pressures, then we must somehow arrange for them to accept inner responsibility for the actions we want them to take. An experiment by Jonathan Friedman gives us some hints about what to do and what not to do in this regard. Friedman wanted to see if he could prevent second to fourth grade boys from playing with a fascinating toy just because he had said that it was wrong to do so some 6 weeks earlier. Anyone familiar with 7 to 9 year old boys must realize the enormity of the task. But Friedman had a plan. If he could first get the boys to convince themselves that it was wrong to play with a forbidden toy, perhaps that belief would keep them from playing with it thereafter. The difficult thing was making the boys believe that it was wrong to amuse themselves with a toy, an extremely expensive battery-controlled robot. Friedman knew it would be easy enough to have a boy obey temporarily. All he had to do was threaten the boy with severe consequences should he be caught playing with the toy. As long as he was nearby to deal out stiff punishment, Friedman figured that few boys would risk operating the robot. He was right. After showing a boy an array of 5 toys and warning him, "It is wrong to play with the robot. If you play with the robot, I'll be very angry and we'll have to do something about it," Friedman left the room for a few minutes. During that time, the boy was observed secretly through a one-way mirror. Friedman tried this threat procedure on 22 different boys, and 21 of them never touched the robot while he was gone. So a strong threat was successful while the boys thought they might get caught and punished. But Friedman had already guessed that. He was really interested in the effectiveness of the threat in guiding the boys' behavior later on, when he was no longer around. To find out what would happen then, he sent a young woman back to the boys' school about 6 weeks after he had been there. She took the boys out of the class one at a time to participate in an experiment. Without ever mentioning any connection with Friedman, she escorted each boy back to the room with the 5 toys and gave him a drawing test. While she was scoring the test, she told the boy that he was free to play with any toy in the room. Of course, almost all the boys played with the toy. The interesting result was that of the boys playing with the toy, 77% chose to play with the robot that had been forbidden to them earlier. Friedman's severe threat, which had been so successful 6 weeks before, was almost totally unsuccessful when he was no longer able to back it up with punishment. But Friedman wasn't finished yet. He changed his procedure slightly with a second sample of boys. These boys, too, were initially shown the array of five toys by Friedman and warned not to play with the robot while he was briefly out of the room because it is wrong to play with the robot. But this time, Friedman provided no strong threat to frighten a boy into obedience. He simply left the room and observed through the one-way mirror to see if his instruction against playing with the forbidden toy was enough. It was. Just as with the other sample, only one of the 22 boys touched the robot during the short time Friedman was gone. The real difference between the two samples of boys came 6 weeks later when they had a chance to play with the toys while Friedman was no longer around. An astonishing thing happened with the boys who had earlier been given no strong threat against playing with the robot. When given the freedom to play with any toy they wished, most avoided the robot, even though it was by far the most attractive of the five toys available. The others were a cheap plastic submarine, a child's baseball glove without a ball, an unloaded toy rifle, and a toy tractor. When these boys played with one of the five toys, only 33% chose the robot. Something dramatic had happened to both groups of boys. For the first group, it was the severe threat they heard from Friedman to back up his statement that playing with the robot was wrong. It had been quite effective at first when Friedman could catch them should they violate his rule. Later, though, when he was no longer present to observe the boys' behavior, his threat was impotent, and his rule was consequently ignored. It seems clear that the threat had not taught the boys that operating the robot was wrong, only that it was unwise to do so when the possibility of punishment existed. For the other boys, the dramatic event had come from the inside, not the outside. Friedman had instructed them, too, that playing with the robot was wrong, but he had added no threat of punishment should they disobey him. There were two important results. First, Friedman's instruction alone was enough to prevent the boys from operating the robot while he was briefly out of the room. Second, the boys took personal responsibility for their choice to stay away from the robot during that time. They decided that they hadn't played with it because they didn't want to. After all, there were no strong punishments associated with the toy to explain their behavior otherwise. Thus, weeks later, when Friedman was nowhere around, they still ignored the robot because they had been changed inside to believe that they did not want to play with it. Adults facing the child-rearing experience can take a cue from the Friedman study. Suppose a couple wants to impress upon their daughter that lying is wrong. A strong, clear threat, "It's bad to lie, honey, so if I catch you at it, I'll cut your tongue out," might well be effective when the parents are present or when the girl thinks she can be discovered. But it will not achieve the larger goal of convincing her that she does not want to lie because she thinks it's wrong. To do that, a much subtler approach is required. A reason must be given that is just strong enough to get her to be truthful most of the time, but is not so strong that she sees it as the obvious reason for her truthfulness. It's a tricky business because exactly what this barely sufficient reason will be changes from child to child. For one little girl, a simple appeal may be enough. "It's bad to lie, honey, so I hope you won't do it." For another child, it may be necessary to add a somewhat stronger reason. "Because if you do, I'll be disappointed in you." For a third child, a mild form of warning may be required as well, and I'll probably have to do something I don't want to do. Wise parents will know which kind of reason will work on their own children. The important thing is to use a reason that will initially produce the desired behavior and will, at the same time, allow a child to take personal responsibility for that behavior. Thus, the less detectable outside pressure such a reason contains, the better. Selecting just the right reason is not an easy task for parents, but the effort should pay off. It is likely to mean the difference between short-lived compliance and long-term commitment. For a pair of reasons we have already talked about, compliance professionals love commitments that produce inner change. First, That change is not just specific to the situation where it first occurred. It covers a whole range of related situations, too. Second, the effects of the change are lasting. So once a man has been induced to take action that shifts his self-image to that of, let's say, a public-spirited citizen, he is likely to be public-spirited in a variety of other circumstances where his compliance may also be desired, and he is likely to continue his public-spirited behavior for as long as his new self-image holds. There is yet another attraction in commitments that lead to interchange. They grow their own legs. There is no need for the compliance professional to undertake a costly and continuing effort to reinforce the change. The pressure for consistency will take care of all that. After our friend comes to view himself as a public-spirited citizen, he will automatically begin to see things differently. He will convince himself that it is the correct way to be. He will begin to pay attention to facts he hadn't noticed before about the value of community service. He will make himself available to hear arguments he hadn't heard before favoring civic action, and he will find such arguments more persuasive than before. In general, because of the need to be consistent within his system of beliefs, he will assure himself that his choice to take public-spirited action was right. What is important about this process of generating additional reasons to justify the commitment is that the reasons are new. Thus, even if the original reason for the civic-minded behavior was taken away, these newly discovered reasons might be enough by themselves to support his perception that he had behaved correctly. The advantage to an unscrupulous compliance professional is tremendous. Because we build new struts to undergird choices we have committed ourselves to, an exploitative individual can offer us an inducement for making such a choice, and after the decision has been made, can remove that inducement, knowing that our decision will probably stand on its own newly created legs. New car dealers frequently try to benefit from this process through a trick they call throwing a lowball. I first encountered the tactic while posing as a sales trainee at a local Chevrolet dealership. After a week of basic instruction, I was allowed to watch the regular salesman perform. One practice that caught my attention right away was the lowball. For certain customers, a very good price is offered on a car, perhaps as much as $400 below competitors' prices. The good deal, however, is not genuine. The dealer never intends it to go through. Its only purpose is to cause a prospect to decide to buy one of the dealership's cars. Once the decision is made, a number of activities develop the customer's sense of personal commitment to the car. A raft of purchase forms are filled out, extensive financing terms are arranged. Sometimes the customer is encouraged to drive the car for a day before signing the contract, so you can get the feel of it, and show it around in the neighborhood and at work. During this time, the dealer knows customers automatically develop a range of new reasons to support the choice they have now made. Then something happens. Occasionally, an error in the calculations is discovered. Maybe the salesman forgot to add in the cost of the air conditioner. And if the buyer still requires air conditioning, $400 must be added to the price. To keep from being suspected of gouging by the customer, some dealers let the bank handling the financing find the mistake. At other times, the deal is disallowed at the last moment when the salesman checks with his boss, who cancels it because we'd be losing money. For only another $400, the car can be had, which, in the context of a multi-thousand-dollar deal, doesn't seem too steep since, as the salesman emphasizes, the cost is equal to competitors, and this is the car you chose, right? Another even more insidious form of lowballing occurs when the salesman makes an inflated trade-in offer on the prospect's old car as part of the buy-trade package. The customer recognizes the offer as overly generous and jumps at the deal. Later, before the contract is signed, the used car manager says that the salesman's estimate was $400 too high and reduces the trade-in allowance to its actual Blue Book level. The customer, realizing that the reduced offer is the fair one, accepts it as appropriate and sometimes feels guilty about trying to take advantage of the salesman's high estimate. I once witnessed a woman provide an embarrassed apology to a salesman who had used the last version of lowballing on her. This while she was signing a new car contract, giving him a huge commission. He looked hurt, but managed a forgiving smile. No matter which variety of lowballing is used, the sequence is the same. An advantage is offered that induces a favorable purchase decision. Then, sometime after the decision has been made, but before the bargain is sealed, the original purchase advantage is deftly removed. It seems almost incredible that a customer would buy a car under these circumstances. Yet it works, not on everybody, of course, but it is effective enough to be a staple compliance procedure in many, many car showrooms. Automobile dealers have come to understand the ability of a personal commitment to build its own support system, a support system of new justifications for the commitment. Often these justifications provide so many strong legs for the decision to stand on that when the dealer pulls away only one leg, the original one, there is no collapse. The loss can be shrugged off by the customer who is consoled, even made happy by the array of other good reasons favoring the choice. It never occurs to the buyer that those additional reasons might never have existed had the choice not been made in the first place. The impressive thing about the lowball tactic is its ability to make a person feel pleased with a poor choice. Those who have only poor choices to offer us, then, are especially fond of the technique. We can find them throwing lowballs in business, social, and personal situations. For instance, there's my neighbor Tim, a true lowball aficionado. Recall that he's the one who, by promising to change his ways, got his girlfriend Sarah to cancel her impending marriage to another, and to take him back. Since her decision for Tim, Sarah has become more devoted to him than ever, even though he has not fulfilled his promises. She explains this by saying that she has allowed herself to see all sorts of positive qualities in Tim she had never recognized before. I know full well that Sarah is a lowball victim. Just as sure as I had watched buyers fall for the give-it-and-take-it-away-later strategy in the car showroom, I watched her fall for the same trick with Tim. For his part, Tim remains the guy he has always been. But because the new attractions Sarah has discovered, or created in him, are quite real for her, she now seems satisfied with the same arrangement that was unacceptable before her enormous commitment. The decision to choose Tim, poor as it may have been objectively, has grown its own supports and appears to have made Sarah genuinely happy. I have never mentioned to Sarah what I know about lowballing. The reason for my silence is not that I think her better off in the dark on the issue. As a general guiding principle, more information is always better than less information. It's just that if I said a word, I am confident she would hate me for it. Depending on the motives of the person wishing to use them, any of the compliance techniques discussed in this audiobook can be employed for good or for ill. It should not be surprising, then, that the lowball tactic can be used for more socially beneficial purposes than selling new cars or reestablishing relationships with former lovers. One research project done in Iowa, for example, shows how the lowball procedure can influence homeowners to conserve energy. The project, headed by Dr. Michael Palak, began at the start of the Iowa winter when residents who heated their homes with natural gas were contacted by an interviewer. The interviewer gave them some energy conservation tips and asked them to try to save fuel in the future. Although they all agreed to try, when the researchers examined the utility records of these families after a month and again at winter's end, it was clear that no real savings had occurred. The residents who had promised to make a conservation attempt used just as much natural gas as a random sample of their neighbors who had not been contacted by an interviewer. Just good intentions, coupled with information about saving fuel, then, were not enough to change habits. Even before the project began, Palak and his research team had recognized that something more would be needed to shift long-standing energy patterns. So they tried a slightly different procedure on a comparable sample of Iowa natural gas users. These people, too, were contacted by an interviewer, who provided energy-saving hints and asked them to conserve. But for these families, the interviewer offered something else. Those residents, agreeing to save energy, would have their names publicized in newspaper articles as public-spirited, fuel-conserving citizens. The effect was immediate. 1 month later, when the utility companies checked their meters, the homeowners in this sample had saved an average of 422 cubic feet of natural gas apiece. The chance to have their names in the paper had motivated these residents to substantial conservation efforts for a period of a month. Then the rug was pulled out. The researchers extracted the reason that had initially caused these people to save fuel. Each family that had been promised publicity received a letter saying it would not be possible to publicize their names after all. At the end of the winter, the research team examined the effect that letter had had on the natural gas usage of the families. Did they return to their old wasteful habits when the chance to be in the newspaper was removed? Hardly. For each of the remaining winter months, they actually conserved more fuel than they had during the time they thought they would be publicly celebrated for it. In terms of percentage of energy savings, they had managed a 12.2% first-month gas savings because they expected to see themselves lauded in the paper. But after the letter arrived informing them to the contrary, they did not return to their previous energy use levels. Instead, they increased their savings to a 15.5% level for the rest of the winter. Although we can never be completely sure of such things, one explanation for their persistent behavior presents itself immediately. These people had been lowballed into a conservation commitment through a promise of newspaper publicity. Once made, that commitment started generating its own support. The homeowners began acquiring new energy habits, began feeling good about their public-spirited efforts, began convincing themselves of the vital need to reduce American dependence on foreign oil, began appreciating the monetary savings in their utility bills, began feeling proud of their capacity for self-denial, and most important, began viewing themselves as conservation-minded. With all these new reasons present to justify the commitment to use less energy, it is no wonder that the commitment remained firm even after the original reason, newspaper publicity, had been kicked away. But strangely enough, when the publicity factor was no longer a possibility, these families did not merely maintain their fuel-saving effort, they heightened it. Any of a number of interpretations could be offered for that still stronger effort, but I have a favorite. In a way, the opportunity to receive newspaper publicity had prevented the homeowners from fully owning their commitment to conservation. Of all the reasons supporting the decision to try to save fuel, it was the only one that had come from the outside. It was the only one preventing the homeowners from thinking that they were conserving gas because they believed in it. So when the letter arrived canceling the publicity agreement, it removed the only impediment to these residents' images of themselves as fully concerned, energy-conscious citizens. This unqualified new self-image then pushed them to even greater heights of conservation. Whether or not such an explanation is correct, a repeat study done by Palak indicates that this hidden benefit of the lowball tactic is no fluke. The experiment was done in summer on Iowans whose homes were cooled by central air conditioning. Those homeowners who were promised newspaper publicity decreased their electricity use by 27.8% during July, as compared to similar homeowners who were not promised any coverage or who were not contacted at all. At the end of July, a letter was sent canceling the publicity promise. Rather than reverting to their old habits, the low-balled residents increased their August energy savings to a stunning 41.6%. Much like Sarah, they appeared to have become committed to a choice through an initial inducement and were still more dedicated to it after the inducement had been removed. How to say no. Consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds. Or at least, so goes a frequently heard quotation attributed to Ralph Waldo Emerson. But what a very odd thing to say. Looking around, it is obvious that, quite contrary to what Emerson seems to have suggested, internal consistency is a hallmark of logic and intellectual strength, while its lack characterizes the intellectually scattered and limited among us. What, then, could a thinker of Emerson's caliber have meant when he assigned the trait of consistency to the small-minded? I was sufficiently intrigued to go back to the original source of his statement, the essay Self-Reliance, where it was clear that the problem lay not in Emerson, but in the popular version of what he had said. Actually, he wrote, "A foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds." For some obscure reason, a central distinction had been lost as the years eroded the accurate version of his statement to mean something entirely different, and, upon close inspection, entirely silly. That distinction should not be lost on us, however, because it is vital to the only effective defense I know against the weapons of influence embodied in the combined principles of commitment and consistency. Although consistency is generally good, even vital, there is a foolish, rigid variety to be shunned. It is this tendency to be automatically and unthinkingly consistent that Emerson referred to. And it is this tendency that we must be wary of, for it lays us open to the maneuvers of those who want to exploit the mechanical commitment consistency sequence for profit. But since automatic consistency is so useful in allowing us an economical and appropriate way of behaving most of the time, we can't decide merely to eliminate it from our lives altogether. The results would be disastrous. If, rather than whirring along in accordance with our prior decisions and deeds, we stopped to think through the merits of every new action before performing it, we would never have time to accomplish anything significant. We need even that dangerous, mechanical brand of consistency. The only way out of the dilemma is to know when such consistency is likely to lead to a poor choice. There are certain signals, two separate kinds of signals, in fact, to tip us off. We register each type in a different part of our bodies. The first sort of signal is easy to recognize. It occurs right in the pit of our stomachs, when we realize we are trapped into complying with a request we know we don't want to perform. It has happened to me 100 times. An especially memorable instance, though, took place on a summer evening well before I began to study compliance tactics. I answered my doorbell to find a stunning young woman dressed in shorts and a revealing halter top. I noticed nonetheless that she was carrying a clipboard and was asking me to participate in a survey. Wanting to make a favorable impression, I agreed and, I do admit, stretched the truth in my interview answers so as to present myself in the most positive light. Our conversation went as follows. "Stunning young woman. Hello, I'm doing a survey on the entertainment habits of city residents, and I wonder if you could answer a few questions for me." Cialdini. "Do come in." "Thank you, I'll just sit right here and begin. How many times per week would you say that you go out to dinner?" "Oh, probably 3, maybe 4 times a week. Whenever I can, really. I love fine restaurants." "How nice. And do you usually order wine with your dinner?"
"Only if it's imported."
"I see. What about movies? Do you go to the movies much?"
"The cinema? I can't get enough of good films. I especially like the sophisticated kind with the words in the bottom of the screen. How about you? Do you like to see films?"
Yes, I do. But let's get back to the interview. Do you go to many concerts?"
"Definitely. The symphonic stuff mostly, of course. But I do enjoy a quality pop group as well."
Writing rapidly. "Great. Just one more question. What about touring performances by theatrical or ballet companies? Do you see them when they're in town?"
"Ah, the ballet. The movement, the grace, the form. I love it. Mark me down as loving the ballet. See it every chance I get."
"Fine. Just let me recheck my figures here for a moment, Mr. Cialdini."
"Actually, it's Dr. Cialdini, but that sounds so formal. Why don't you call me Bob?"
"All right, Bob. From the information you've already given me, I'm pleased to say that you could save up to $1,200 a year by joining Club America. A small membership fee entitles you to discounts on most of the activities you've mentioned. Surely someone as socially vigorous as yourself would want to take advantage of the tremendous savings our company can offer on all the things you've already told me you do."
trapped like a rat. Well, I guess so. I remember quite well feeling my stomach tighten as I stammered my agreement. It was a clear call to my brain. Hey, you're being taken here. But I couldn't see a way out. I had been cornered by my own words. To decline her offer at that point would have meant facing a pair of distasteful alternatives. If I tried to back out by protesting that I was not actually the man about town I had claimed to be during the interview, I would come off a liar. But trying to refuse without that protest would make me come off a fool for not wanting to save $1,200. So I bought the entertainment package, even though I knew I had been set up so that the need to be consistent with what I had already said would snare me. No more, though. I listen to my stomach these days, and I have discovered a way to handle people who try to use the consistency principle on me. I just tell them exactly what they are doing. It works beautifully. Most of the time, they don't understand me. They just become sufficiently confused to want to leave me alone. I think they suspect lunacy in anyone who responds to their requests by explaining what Ralph Waldo Emerson meant and distinguishing between consistency and foolish consistency. Usually, they have already begun edging away by the time I have mentioned hobgoblins of the mind and are gone long before I have described the click-whir character of commitment and consistency. Occasionally, though, they realize that I am onto their game. I always know when that happens. It's as clear as the egg on their faces. They invariably become flustered, bumble through a hasty exit line, and go for the door. This tactic has become the perfect counterattack for me. Whenever my stomach tells me I would be a sucker to comply with a request merely because doing so would be consistent with some prior commitment I was tricked into, I relay that message to the requester. I don't deny the importance of consistency, I just point out the absurdity of foolish consistency. Whether in response the requester shrinks away guiltily or retreats in bewilderment, I am content. I have won. An exploiter has lost. I sometimes think about how it would be if that stunning young woman of years ago were to try to sell me an entertainment club membership now. I have it all worked out. The entire interaction would be the same except for the end. Stunning young woman. Surely someone as socially vigorous as yourself would want to take advantage of the tremendous savings our company can offer on all the things you've already told me you do. Cialdini, with great self-assurance. Quite wrong, you see. I recognize what has gone on here. I know that your story about doing a survey was just a pretext for getting people to tell you how often they go out, and that under those circumstances, there is a natural tendency to exaggerate. I also realize that your bosses selected you for this job because of your physical attractiveness and told you to wear clothes showing a lot of your resilient body tissue, because a pretty scantily clad woman is likely to get men to brag about what swingers they are in order to impress her. So I'm not interested in your entertainment club because of what Emerson said about foolish consistency and hobgoblins of the mind. Staring blankly. Huh? Look, what I told you during your fake survey doesn't matter. I refuse to allow myself to be locked into a mechanical sequence of commitment and consistency when I know it's wrong-headed. No click-whir for me. Huh? Okay, let me put it this way. One, it would be stupid of me to spend money on something I don't want. Two, I have it on excellent authority, direct from my stomach, that I don't want your entertainment plan. Three, therefore, if you still believe that I will buy it, you probably also still believe in the tooth fairy. Surely someone as intelligent as yourself would be able to understand that. Trapped like a stunning young rat. Well, I guess so. Stomachs are not especially perceptive or subtle organs. Only when it is obvious that we are about to be conned are they likely to register and transmit that message. At other times, when it is not clear that we are being taken, our stomachs may never catch on. Under those circumstances, we have to look elsewhere for a clue. The situation of my neighbor Sarah provides a good illustration. She made an important commitment to Tim by canceling her prior marriage plans. That commitment has grown its own supports, so that even though the original reasons for the commitment are gone, she remains in harmony with it, She has convinced herself with newly formed reasons that she did the right thing, so she stays with Tim. It is not difficult to see why there would be no tightening in Sarah's stomach as a result. Stomachs tell us when we are doing something we think is wrong for us. Sarah thinks no such thing. To her mind, she has chosen correctly and is behaving consistently with that choice. Yet, unless I badly miss my guess, there is a part of Sarah that recognizes her choice as a mistake and her current living arrangement as a brand of foolish consistency. Where exactly that part of Sarah is located, we can't be sure. But our language does give it a name, Heart of Hearts. It is by definition the one place where we cannot fool ourselves. It is the place where none of our justifications, none of our rationalizations penetrate. Sarah has the truth there, although right now she can't hear its signal clearly through the noise and static of the new support apparatus she has erected. If Sarah has erred in her choice of Tim, how long could she go without clearly recognizing it, without having a massive Heart of Hearts attack? There is no telling. One thing is certain, however, as time passes, the various alternatives to Tim are disappearing. She had better determine soon whether she is making a mistake. Easier said than done, of course. She must answer an extremely intricate question. Knowing what I now know, if I could go back in time, would I make the same choice? The problem lies in the knowing what I now know part of the question. Just what does she now know, accurately, about Tim? How much of what she thinks of him is the result of a desperate attempt to justify the commitment she made? She claims that since her decision to take him back, he cares for her more, is trying hard to stop his excessive drinking, has learned to make a wonderful omelet, etc. Having tasted a couple of his omelets, I have my doubts. The important issue, though, is whether she believes these things, not just intellectually, we can play such mind games on ourselves, but in her heart of hearts. There may be a little device Sarah can use to find out how much of her current satisfaction with Tim is real, and how much is foolish consistency. Accumulating psychological evidence indicates that we experience our feelings towards something a split second before we can intellectualize about it. My suspicion is that the message sent by the Heart of Hearts is a pure, basic feeling. Therefore, if we train ourselves to be attentive, we should register it ever so slightly before our cognitive apparatus engages. According to this approach, were Sarah to ask herself the crucial, would I make the same choice again question, she would be well advised to look for and trust the first flash of feeling she experienced in response. It would likely be the signal from her heart of hearts, slipping through undistorted just before the means by which she could kid herself flooded in. I have begun using the same device myself whenever I even suspect I might be acting in a foolishly consistent manner. One time, for instance, I had stopped at the self-service pump of a filling station advertising a price per gallon a couple of cents below the rate of other stations in the area. But with pump nozzle in hand, I noticed that the price listed on the pump was 2 cents higher than the display sign price. When I mentioned the difference to a passing attendant, who I later learned was the owner, he mumbled unconvincingly that the rates had changed a few days ago, but there hadn't been time to correct the display. I tried to decide what to do. Some reasons for staying came to mind. I really do need gasoline badly. This pump is available, and I am in sort of a hurry. I think I remember that my car runs better on this brand of gas. I needed to determine whether those reasons were genuine or mere justifications for my decision to stop there. So I asked myself the crucial question. Knowing what I know about the real price of this gasoline, if I could go back in time, would I make the same choice again? Concentrating on the first burst of impression I sensed, the answer was clear and unqualified. I would have driven right past. I wouldn't even have slowed down. I knew then, without the price advantage, those other reasons would not have brought me there. They hadn't created the decision. The decision had created them. That settled, there was another decision to be faced, though. Since I was already there, holding the hose, wouldn't it be better to use it than to suffer the inconvenience of going elsewhere to pay the same price? Fortunately, the station attendant owner came over and helped me make up my mind. He asked why I wasn't pumping any gas. I told him I didn't like the price discrepancy, and he said with a snarl, "Listen, nobody's going to tell me how to run my business. If you think I'm cheating you, just put that hose down right now and get off my property as fast as you can do it, bud." Already certain he was a cheat, I was happy to act consistently with my belief and his wishes. I dropped the hose on the spot and drove over it on my way to the closest exit. Sometimes consistency can be a marvelously rewarding thing. Reader's report from a woman living in Portland, Oregon. I was walking through downtown Portland on my way to a lunch appointment when a young, attractive man stopped me with a friendly smile and a powerful line. "Excuse me, I'm involved in a contest, and I need a good-looking woman like yourself to help me win." I was truly skeptical, since I know there are many more attractive women than myself running around. However, I was caught off guard and was curious to find out what he wanted. He explained that he would receive points for a contest by getting total strangers to give him a kiss. Now, I consider myself a fairly level-headed person who shouldn't have believed his line, but he was quite persistent. And since I was almost late for my lunch appointment, I thought, what the heck, I'll give the guy a kiss and get out of here. So I did something totally against my common sense and pecked this total stranger on the cheek in the middle of downtown Portland. I thought that would be the end of it, but I soon learned that it was just the beginning. Much to my distress, he followed the kiss with the line, "You are a great kisser, but the real contest I'm involved in is to sell magazine subscriptions. You must be an active person. Would any of these magazines interest you?" At this point, I should have slugged the guy and walked away, but somehow, because I had complied with his initial request, I felt a need to be consistent, and I complied with his second request. Yes, much to my own disbelief, I actually subscribed to Ski Magazine, which I occasionally enjoy reading but had no intention of subscribing to, gave him a $5 initial subscription fee, and left as quickly as possible, feeling quite frustrated with what I had just done and not understanding why I had done it. Although it still pains me to think about it, in reflecting on the incident after reading your book, I've now figured out what happened. The reason this tactic worked so effectively is because once small commitments have been made, in this case giving a kiss, people tend to add justifications to support the commitment and then are willing to commit themselves further. In this situation, I justified complying with the second request because it was consistent with my initial action. If I had only listened to my stomach signs, I could have saved myself a lot of humiliation. By extracting a kiss, the salesman exploited the consistency principle in two ways. First, by the time he asked for her aid in the magazine contest, his prospect had already gone on record with that kiss as agreeing to help him win a contest. Second, it seems only natural, i.e. congruent, that if a woman feels positively enough toward a man to kiss him, she should feel positively toward helping him out. Chapter 4. Social Proof. Truths Are Us. Where all think alike, no one thinks very much. Walter Lippmann. I don't know anyone who likes canned laughter. In fact, when I surveyed the people who came into my office one day, several students, two telephone repairmen, a number of university professors, and the janitor, the reaction was invariably critical. Television, with its incessant system of laugh tracks and technically augmented mirth, received the most heat. The people I questioned hated canned laughter. They called it stupid, phony, and obvious. Although my sample was small, I would bet that it closely reflects the negative feelings of most of the American public toward laugh tracks. Why, then, is canned laughter so popular with television executives? They have won their exalted positions and splendid salaries by knowing how to give the public what it wants. Yet they religiously employ the laugh tracks that their audiences find distasteful, and they do so over the objections of many of their most talented artists. It is not uncommon for acclaimed directors, writers, or actors to demand the elimination of canned responses from the television projects they undertake. These demands are only sometimes successful, and when they are, it is not without a battle. What could it be about canned laughter that is so attractive to television executives? Why would these shrewd and tested businessmen champion a practice that their potential watchers find disagreeable and their most creative talents find personally insulting? The answer is at once simple and intriguing. They know what the research says. Experiments have found that the use of canned merriment causes an audience to laugh longer and more often when humorous material is presented, and to rate the material as funnier. In addition, some evidence indicates that canned laughter is most effective for poor jokes. In the light of these data, the actions of television executives make perfect sense. The introduction of laugh tracks into their comic programming will increase the humorous and appreciative responses of an audience, even and especially when the material is of poor quality. Is it any surprise, then, that television, glutted as it is with artless situation comedy attempts, should be saturated with canned laughter? Those executives know precisely what they are doing. But with the mystery of the widespread use of laugh tracks solved, we are left with a more perplexing question. Why does canned laughter work on us the way it does? It is no longer the television executives who appear peculiar. They are acting logically and in their own interests. Instead, it is the behavior of the audience, of you and me, that seems strange. Why should we laugh more at comedy material afloat in a sea of mechanically fabricated merriment? And why should we think that comic flotsam funnier? The executives aren't really fooling us. Anyone can recognize dubbed laughter. It is so blatant, so clearly counterfeit, that there could be no confusing it with the real thing. We know full well that the hilarity we hear is irrelevant to the humorous quality of the joke it follows, that it is created not spontaneously by a genuine audience, but artificially by a technician at a control board. Yet, transparent forgery that it is, it works on us. To discover why canned laughter is so effective, we first need to understand the nature of yet another potent weapon of influence, the principle of social proof. It states that one means we use to determine what is correct is to find out what other people think is correct. The principle applies especially to the way we decide what constitutes correct behavior. We view a behavior as more correct in a given situation to the degree that we see others performing it. Whether the question is what to do with an empty popcorn box in a movie theater, how fast to drive on a certain stretch of highway, or how to eat the chicken at a dinner party, the actions of those around us will be important in defining the answer. The tendency to see an action as more appropriate when others are doing it normally works quite well. As a rule, we will make fewer mistakes by acting in accord with social evidence than contrary to it. Usually, when a lot of people are doing something, it is the right thing to do. This feature of the principle of social proof is simultaneously its major strength and its major weakness. Like the other weapons of influence, it provides a convenient shortcut for determining how to behave, but at the same time, makes one who uses the shortcut vulnerable to the attacks of profiteers who lie in wait along its path. In the case of canned laughter, the problem comes when we begin responding to social proof in such a mindless and reflexive fashion that we can be fooled by partial or fake evidence. Our folly is not that we use others' laughter to help decide what is humorous and when mirth is appropriate. That is in keeping with the well-founded principle of social proof. The folly is that we do so in response to patently fraudulent laughter. Somehow, one disembodied feature of humor, a sound, works like the essence of humor. The example from Chapter 1 of The Turkey and the Polecat is instructive here. Remember that because the particular cheep-cheep of turkey chicks is normally associated with newborn turkeys, their mothers will display or withhold maternal care solely on the basis of that sound. And remember how, consequently, it was possible to trick a female turkey into mothering a stuffed polecat as long as the replica played the recorded cheep-cheep of a baby turkey? The simulated chick sound was enough to start the female's mothering tape whirring. The lesson of the turkey and the polecat illustrates uncomfortably well the relationship between the average viewer and the laugh track playing television executive. We have become so accustomed to taking the humorous reactions of others as evidence of what deserves laughter that we, too, can be made to respond to the sound and not to the substance of the real thing. Much as a cheep-cheep noise removed from the reality of a chick can stimulate a female turkey to mother, so can a recorded ha-ha removed from the reality of a genuine audience stimulate us to laugh. The television executives are exploiting our preference for shortcuts, our tendency to react automatically on the basis of partial evidence. They know that their tapes will cue our tapes. Click. Whirr. Television executives are hardly alone in their use of social evidence for profit. Our tendency to assume that an action is more correct if others are doing it is exploited in a variety of settings. Bartenders often salt their tip jars with a few dollar bills at the beginning of the evening to simulate tips left by prior customers, and thereby to give the impression that tipping with folding money is proper barroom behavior. Church ushers sometimes salt collection baskets for the same reason, and with the same positive effect on proceeds. Evangelical preachers are known to seed their audience with ringers, who are rehearsed to come forward at a specified time to give witness and donations. For example, an Arizona State University research team that infiltrated the Billy Graham organization reported on such advanced preparations prior to one of his crusade visits. By the time Graham arrives in town and makes his altar call, an army of 6,000 wait with instructions on when to come forth, at varying intervals to create the impression of a spontaneous mass outpouring. Advertisers love to inform us when a product is the fastest growing or largest selling because they don't have to convince us directly that the product is good. They need only say that many others think so, which seems proof enough. The producers of charity telethons devote inordinate amounts of time to the incessant listing of viewers who have already pledged contributions. The message being communicated to the holdouts is clear. Look at all the people who have decided to give. It must be the correct thing to do. At the height of the disco craze, certain discotheque owners manufactured a brand of visible social proof for their club's quality by creating long waiting lines outside when there was plenty of room inside. Salesmen are taught to spice their pitches with numerous accounts of individuals who have purchased the product. Sales and motivation consultant Cabot Robert captures the principle nicely in his advice to sales trainees. Since 95% of the people are imitators and only 5% initiators, people are persuaded more by the actions of others than by any proof we can offer. Researchers, too, have employed procedures based on the principle of social proof, sometimes with astounding results. One psychologist in particular, Albert Bandura, has led the way in developing such procedures for the elimination of undesirable behavior. Bandura and his colleagues have shown how people suffering from phobias can be rid of these extreme fears in an amazingly simple fashion. For instance, in an early study, nursery school-aged children chosen because they were terrified of dogs merely watched a little boy playing happily with a dog for 20 minutes a day. This exhibition produced such marked changes in the reactions of the fearful children that after only 4 days, 67% of them were willing to climb into a playpen with a dog and remain confined there, petting and scratching it while everyone else left the room. Moreover, when the researchers tested the children's fear levels again 1 month later, they found that the improvement had not evaporated during that time. In fact, the children were more willing than ever to interact with dogs. An important practical discovery was made in a second study of children who were exceptionally afraid of dogs. To reduce their fears, it was not necessary to provide live demonstrations of another child playing with a dog. Film clips had the same effect, and the most effective type of clips were those depicting not one, but a variety of other children interacting with their dogs. Apparently, the principle of social proof works best when the proof is provided by the actions of a lot of other people. The powerful influence of filmed examples in changing the behavior of children can be used as therapy for various problems. Some striking evidence is available in the research of psychologist Robert O'Connor on socially withdrawn preschool children. We have all seen children of this sort, terribly shy, standing alone at the fringes of the games and groupings of their peers. O'Connor worried that a long-term pattern of isolation was forming, even at an early age, that would create persistent difficulties in social comfort and adjustment through adulthood. In an attempt to reverse the pattern, O'Connor made a film containing 11 different scenes in a nursery school setting. Each scene began by showing a different solitary child watching some ongoing social activity and then actively joining the activity to everyone's enjoyment. O'Connor selected a group of the most severely withdrawn children from 4 preschools and showed them his film. The impact was impressive. The isolates immediately began to interact with their peers at a level equal to that of the normal children in the schools. Even more astonishing was what O'Connor found when he returned to observe 6 weeks later. While the withdrawn children who had not seen O'Connor's film remained as isolated as ever, those who had viewed it were now leading their schools in amount of social activity. It seems that this 23-minute movie, viewed just once, was enough to reverse a potential pattern of lifelong maladaptive behavior. Such is the potency of the principle of social proof. When it comes to illustrations of the strength of social proof, there is one that is far and away my favorite. Several features account for its appeal. It offers a superb example of the much underused method of participant observation, in which a scientist studies a process by becoming immersed in its natural occurrence. It provides information of interest to such diverse groups as historians, psychologists, and theologians. And most important, it shows how social evidence can be used on us, not by others, but by ourselves, to assure us that what we prefer to be true will seem to be true. The story is an old one, requiring an examination of ancient data, for the past is dotted with millennial religious movements. Various sects and cults have prophesied that on one or another particular date, there would arrive a period of redemption and great happiness for those who believed in the group's teachings. In each instance, it has been predicted that the beginning of the time of salvation would be marked by an important and undeniable event, usually the cataclysmic end of the world. Of course, these predictions have invariably proved false. To the